Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program was brought to you by Brooklyn Ball Factory, a Japanese eatery and coffee shop in East Williamsburg, with a new location opening in Hell's Kitchen. Learn more at bkballfactory.com.
I'm Damon Bolte, host of The Speakeasy. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Japan Eats. I'm your host, Akiko Katayama, a food writer and the director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deeper understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. We are broadcasting live from a studio at Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every deli in the supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi ramen izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is still a mystery for many people, and I try to demystify it in this program with my cool guest. And my guest today is Mutsuko Soma, who is a soba chef based in Seattle. Everybody knows ramen in the U.S. now, but soba is not very well known, despite the fact that you can find a soba shop at almost every corner in Japan. And Mutsuko studied soba making in Japan and has worked as soba chef in Seattle for the last 7 years. So today we will talk about Mutsuko's interesting career development to become a soba chef, what exactly soba is, what it is so why is it so popular in Japan, and how to eat soba, and much, much more. But quickly before we start, Heritage Radio Network is a not-for-profit organization, and we need your support. So please go to our website, heritageradionetwork.org, and click on the pounding heart to help us. So thank you so much. Now let's start our conversation with Mutsuko Soma. Hello, Mutsuko. Welcome to Japan Eats.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So, first, you are from Tochigi Prefecture in Japan. Mm-hmm. And according to the 2015 data, Tochigi is the fifth largest soba-making prefecture in Japan, out of 50 prefectures. So, did you eat a lot of soba when you grew up?
Yes, a lot. My grandma always make me soba when I was a kid. She lived in also Tochigi Prefecture, 1 hour away from my house. And I usually visit her house once a month. And my cousin, aunt, uncle usually visit her same time. So my grandma is like preparing large batch of soba for us.
That's a lot of work. So what kind of person your grandmother was?
She was like old school farmer. Like she grew everything by herself. Like she grew rice, buckwheat, vegetable, and also she like foraging a lot. Like springtime, she catch, you know, bamboo shoot. Summertime, she catch true water crab from river, and you know, fall time also mushroom.
Wow. So she's like a totally sustainable Seattle kind of person.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, but you told me before the show we were chatting and she had only one arm. So, and she still made a soba.
Yeah.
Impossible.
She lost her arm like when she was young by accident. So she makes soba, but her technique is super unique. Usually when I make soba, I use like large bowl to mixing dough. But since she has one arm, she used skinny pitcher to mixing dough. Like using like both legs to holding pitcher and just mix.
Right.
Also, she has like old school kitchen. It's like not electronic at all.
Wow.
She used wood fire to cook noodle because wood fire has like high temperature. Then she used well water to shack soba.
That's like totally slow food. She gave me a present of slow food to Japan, right? Or something like that. Wow.
So that's experience was like biggest inspiration for me.
Mm-hmm. Right. So, but speaking of when did you come to the U.S. and why did you come to the U.S.?
That was 2001, after I graduated high school.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
When I was in high school, I was interested in cooking, but I couldn't choose like which cuisine I should pick. Like maybe Japanese, maybe French, maybe Italian. Then 2001, fusion cuisine was popular.
Mm.
Like Wolfgang Puck started.
Right, that was a good time.
Yeah. So I'm like, oh, maybe I should go California. Mm. They have like melting pot culture. Like I can learn traditional things from, you know, authentic people. Mm. You know, Italian food from Italian, French from French people. Mm. And also combination of lots of different things.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I choose California.
Right. So you didn't think of making soba at that point?
No.
Right. And you went to the Art Institute of America, Seattle,
uh-huh.
and then majored in culinary art.
Uh-huh.
Right. And so where did you work after graduation from the Art Institute?
I work at, well, first of all, I moved to California to Seattle, right?
Because mm-hmm.
I found out like California has basically no season always.
Right.
So like Seattle has four seasons, mountain, ocean, pure water, great mm. ingredient. So I transfer school to Seattle.
Interesting.
Uh-huh.
Huh. Because, you know, people say the whole bounty are in California, uh-huh. and then you decided to go to Seattle. So what's the difference? Like, it's more kind of, I don't know, the seasonally distinctive, like you said, and more different kinds of ingredients.
I noticed lots of things are similar to Japan. Like I said, four season and micro season. There's 24 season in a year, right. I believe.
Oh, interesting. Uh-huh. And there's a rainy season too, like in Japan.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So I'm sure you did well at school.
Mm-hmm.
And so where did you work after your graduation?
The restaurant called Harvest Vine. Mm-hmm. Which Basque Spanish influenced restaurant.
Wow. Uh-huh. That was the beginning of modern Spanish time, or?
They do more traditional style.
Okay.
But has French influence and Spanish influence, because mm-hmm. somewhere between Spain and France.
Mm-hmm.
And also they have mountain and ocean, so uh-huh. lots of seafood, lots of meat, like goat and cheese.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Well, sounds like your grandmother founded
some
basic idea of cooking.
Uh-huh. My chef was kind of my grandma.
Oh, really?
Uh-huh.
Oh, wow. Okay, so you're always lucky to have masters
uh-huh.
in your life. Okay. And I also heard in 2006, you became the executive chef
mm-hmm.
at a famous French restaurant called Chez Chez
uh-huh.
at the age of 25. So how did it happen?
I was kind of lucky. Initially, I was started as a sous chef.
Mm-hmm.
Then executive chef, like, quit like shortly, like has high turnover that mm-hmm. point. Then I got promoted. Of course, I was very working hard.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
So, but executive chef at the French, because uh-huh. you were working at a Spanish restaurant and uh-huh. now you're French. So was it difficult to switch to French cuisine?
Well, Harvest Spain was like heavily Basque influence, so more close to French side. So mm. it's not hard to transfer.
Okay,
mm-hmm.
right. So Basque is between Spain and France, so
yeah.
that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then in 2008, you moved to Tokyo
mm-hmm.
with your American husband. So what happened?
I'm always wondering, like, oh, can I do a good job in Tokyo?
Because
mm. people say, oh, your food is great in Seattle. But I'm always, like, thinking about my cooking, like, okay, I may be good here, but I may be not good in Tokyo. So I want to challenge myself.
Mm.
And my husband is half Japanese, so he always wants to live in Tokyo.
Ah.
So we're like, let's do it.
Right.
Uh-huh.
Oh, wow. That's great. And then, so he decided, like, both mutually agreed to move.
Uh-huh.
Right. Okay. So what did you do when you were in Japan?
So I found that working kitchen is very hard. Like, I have to start over from dishwasher or something. So that time, I was interested in wine a lot. So I studied wine more, then took sommelier exam in Japan. Mm. I was working as a sommelier in French restaurant.
Right. Mm. You're such a go-getter.
I know.
Right. So, and then did you really enjoy working as a sommelier?
Yeah, then I started liking more and more and more about wine. Mm. And I started visiting like wine country, like Yamanashi or like Nagano Prefecture, mm-hmm. which great place to growing Japanese grape and making wine.
Right. Actually, Japanese wine started to be finally recognized, uh-huh. and they have unique grapes.
Yeah, like Koshu grape.
Right. Mm-hmm. Okay. So, but you didn't stay in the business, obviously, in wine, so...
Well, actually, after I was in Tokyo, I moved to Yamanashi.
Oh, really?
Yeah. To do... like part-time chef, part-time like winemaking and grape growing job.
Wow, it's like a dream. Uh-huh. But where's your husband?
That time he got job offered in Seattle, so he moved back to Seattle first. Okay. So just by myself went to Yamanashi.
Mm. So wow, your husband is very supportive. Okay.
And well, I notice if I leave US more than 6 months, I lose green card. I didn't know that. So that point, I lost my green card.
Right.
Then I was reapplying green card. Then I was waiting for my new green card to arrive.
Wow, which could take a long time.
A lot. My case took like 2.5 years.
Really?
Uh-huh.
Wow, even if you're married to an American husband.
Uh-huh.
Wow, that's very difficult. So you had to spend 2.5 years by mm-hmm. yourself. And... so you were running a kind of a kitchen mm-hmm. and doing the sommelier and the chef.
Mm-hmm.
And then you didn't think of being a soba thing yet?
No, then after busy season end,
mm-hmm.
I'm like, okay, what can I do? What can I learn when I'm in Japan? Something I cannot do in US.
Mm.
Then I'm like, oh, soba.
Okay, because you're so familiar with uh-huh. your grandmother's.
I was lucky enough, I never had dry noodle soba until I come to US.
Oh.
So like, oh, dry noodle suck. I want right. fresh soba.
Oh, you were so lucky.
Uh-huh.
Mm.
Then I was looking for soba school. Initially, I was thinking, oh, maybe I should ask my grandma, but she has one arm and she has like super amazing, crazy technique. Like, oh, I can do this.
Right. Uh-huh. Okay. So you... you went to learn some at soba school or something like that? Or how did you learn soba?
That soba school is connected with Gen, which I work after.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay.
So there's a three-story building, like first floor restaurant, second floor meeting facility, and fourth floor is like teaching class with like dormitory.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Wow, dormitory.
Mm-hmm.
That sounds like a very traditional.
Yeah. It's located in Tateishi, which drinking town. So mm-hmm. I had lots
of
fun.
In Tokyo.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So you signed up, and then mm-hmm. they start teaching you uh-huh. in a traditional way of traditional soba. Wow. How long did it take?
It's a 1 month program.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Wow. How did you find it?
Online. I was looking for like, oh, somewhere I can stay. So like soba class with dormitory.
Mm. Okay. Mm-hmm. And then did you see any different kind of techniques compared to your grandmother's?
Lots of difference.
Mm. Uh-huh.
I'm glad I have 2 arms.
Oh, wow. So, I mean, what is so special about soba for you? You know, like, of course, it's the memory thing. Your taste, your palate is trained to taste the best soba.
Mm-hmm.
But is it, you know, it's such a challenging technique,
uh-huh.
right? So, but you still wanted to learn and be uh-huh. a master of soba?
I think all technique has, like, meaning. Like, all process is, like, so beautiful and like carefully made, so it's like a making a base, like how to say, if I'm like making soba, make me my mind clear.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Oh wow, Zen process.
Yeah, Zen moment.
Right, so we're going to talk about the exact process later, but uh-huh. Oh, that's interesting.
Uh-huh.
So the spiritual aspect of making soba.
Yeah.
Right, okay. And so what was the biggest challenge technically to study soba making?
Because everything done by hand, and humidity change, and temperature change every day.
Right.
So how you add water, how fast you are adding water, how you want to mix, like change every day, every moment. So you have to be careful, like what ingredient this ingredient wants, like as a buckwheat flour need.
Right. So it sounds like you have to be present, mindful.
Yeah.
Zen mindset, seriously. Wow, that's interesting. And so after you finished the school, what did you work in Japan as a soba chef?
Mm-hmm. Actually, I stayed 2 more months so I can learn how to make buckwheat. Because I made buckwheat noodle from Washington State.
Okay.
At soba school. Mm. Oh, maybe I can bring stone mill to U.S. I can make my own buckwheat flour.
Interesting. So that's the majority that's used in Japan? That the flour from soba buckwheat from Seattle?
Mostly from China. And some from Canada, some from Washington State. Mm. But Washington is the largest state to import buckwheat from U.S.
Mm. Interesting. But not much in Japanese. Buckwheat?
A lot more than Japanese-made buckwheat.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Wow, that's very impressive. I didn't know anything about that. Okay. So, yeah, so did you work at the restaurant?
Uh-huh. It's kind of a crazy story. One of our same school graduate student, he figured how to make opium from shichimi togarashi.
Oh, that's shichimi is the seven flavor.
Uh-huh.
Togarashi, that pepper.
Yeah,
but
yeah,
then
yeah.
He managed to make
opium.
Okay.
Because shichimi has poppy seed.
Right. Uh-huh.
Then he got busted by police. He had beautiful restaurant in Karuizawa, which like summer vacation, like touristy place, right?
Right, like a Hampton, like summer resort kind
of.
Right.
So me and my soba teacher and other graduate student like got bonded to do one summer only soba restaurant in there, at his restaurant.
Oh, wow.
Uh-huh.
So you got lucky. He was unlucky, but you got lucky. Mm-hmm. Right. How do you like the experience?
It was good, like every day busy, so I got like lots of hands-on training a lot.
Right. And then eventually you decided to go back to Seattle.
That fall, finally, my green card arrived.
Oh,
so.
Celebration. Okay. And your husband is, of course,
yeah,
in Seattle.
He was waiting for me.
Okay. So so how did you start your career as a soba chef in Seattle?
So soba noodle wasn't popular in Seattle at all. People associate soba noodle equal dry soba noodle. So I started doing pop-up.
Okay.
Which, like... using restaurant space to do like one night only restaurant.
Right. Japanese restaurant?
Both Japanese restaurant, American restaurant.
So you're serving traditional soba noodles. What was the reaction? Because at soba, it's hard to explain in a way. Ramen people started to know. And I think udon, I think it's more known for some reason. Because I think classically, back in old days, Japanese restaurants started to serve sukiyaki and udon, like udon dishes, like curry udon or something like that. Right. So how did you explain to your customers what soba is? And
I just explained like basic things, you know, from buckwheat flour, handmade. It's like a fresh pasta of Japanese way.
Okay. So people started to get interested in soba. Okay.
And they like it.
And then in 2013, you opened Miyabi 45th as a chef and a co-owner. So what happened and how did it happen?
Well, one of the restaurants I pop up, the restaurant owner is like, oh, your concept is great. Like, let's do restaurant together.
Wow, that's very nice.
Yeah, I was lucky.
Is he an American person?
No, she's Japanese.
Okay.
She also has sushi restaurant in Seattle.
Oh, wow. So sounds like Seattle is very food-rich, also Japanese food-oriented city.
Yeah.
Interesting.
I think because Seattle is similar to Japan.
Right. Okay, and I think... back in old days, there are some immigrants from Japan, like 1930s or something like that?
I think so, yes.
Right. Okay. And so what kind of restaurant was Miyabi 45th?
So because of my experience, was like Spanish and French. So appetizer is kind of more European style, but using Japanese ingredient.
Okay. Like, for instance?
number one favorite dish was foie gras tofu.
Mm-hmm.
You know, tofu is made from soybean, but I made tofu from foie gras. So kind of texture of tofu, and it is tofu, but foie gras, it's like a cross between tofu and foie gras mousse.
Mm, mm-hmm. Like a richer,
yeah.
More koku, people say in Japanese, right? Like richer, denser mouthfeel. Okay. And then in terms of soba, what kind of soba did you serve?
So I did half traditional and half creative one. Because people think, oh, you're having noodle restaurant. Where's your ramen?
Mm.
So I cannot say, oh, sorry, I don't have ramen. Mm. Or I don't have sushi anytime.
Right.
So my answer is like, okay, we don't have ramen, but we have similar things.
Mm.
Then I create called chashu namban.
Okay.
It's a hot soba noodle, but having chashu and marinated egg on top.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. Well, maybe you can explain to our listeners, because soba, basically the most bare classic one, mm-hmm. what kind of dish is really typical when it comes to Japanese traditional soba restaurant?
Most typical soba, I think tempura soba, which just hot noodle in hot broth with side of tempura.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Then my favorite classic dish is kamo namban, which hot noodle in hot broth with slice of duck breast and duck meatball made from duck leg.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And leek, of course.
That's my favorite too, actually. Right. But, you know, you can be only, you know, just bare soba noodles. Mm-hmm. You know, like
zaru soba,
right?
Dipping sauce.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But then, because it's so simple, you are asked to make the noodles texture the best and the dashi the best, dipping sauce the best.
Mm-hmm.
So it could be really a challenge.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. It's like to me, it's like the best, most wonderful bread that you can eat by itself. It tastes so much more than just you don't need the butter or anything.
Uh-huh.
It's a great bread, and to me, great soba is the texture and the flavor.
Uh huh.
Yeah, you can really smell the flour, right? So that's the variation. Did you serve zaru soba, the kind of simple version?
Of course.
Right. Okay, what about the creative soba?
Creative soba. So, let's see. Chashu namban was popular, but also hiyashi chashu was popular, which I took inspiration from hiyashi chuka. It's a cold noodle with dashi and sesame sauce, and I served with karashi, Chinese mustard, instead of wasabi.
Right. Mm-hmm. So the chashu and also hiyashi chuka, like those are Chinese versions, like closer to ramen, right? And chashu is a famous topping for ramen.
Uh-huh.
So kind of mixed both idea of
yeah,
ramen,
yeah.
So that it's familiar to people. Mm, interesting. Okay. And you decided to leave Miyabi 45th in 2016, right? So why?
Well, I found out I was pregnant on 2015. Then I worked until week 38. Then I took 6 months maternity leave. Then my business partner wants to go different direction. So I decided to not coming back.
Okay. But I saw all those past media reviews. That's really, people went nuts about your soba.
Yeah.
Right. So I'm sure people missing you still a lot.
I hope so.
Yeah. Okay. So let's take a quick break here. And when we come back, we'll talk about what exactly soba is and its health benefit. So please stay with us.
This episode is brought to you by Brooklyn Ball Factory, a Japanese eatery and coffee shop located at 95 Montrose Avenue in East Williamsburg. Behind its large steel doors, Brooklyn Ball Factory is brewing up some of the city's best tea and coffee. Grab a pour-over, matcha latte, or yuzu ginger mint tea. For lunch, Brooklyn Ball Factory offers sandwiches and curries. Or think inside the box and order one of their bentos, like meatball, grilled veggies, or pork shabu shabu. The meatballs, a favorite, are made with beef chuck roll and short rib in a sweet sour sauce of apples cooked in soy. And did we mention the roof deck? After your coffee and food have been prepared, climb the staircase behind the counter to find an oasis in the middle of Brooklyn. Visit Brooklyn Ball Factory at 95 Montrose Avenue in Williamsburg and check out their new location opening in Hell's Kitchen. Learn more at bkballfactory.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Japan Eats, broadcasting live from a studio in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I'm your host, Akiko Katayama, and my guest today is Mutsuko Soma, who is a soba chef based in Seattle. So now let's talk about soba. For listeners who are not familiar with soba, could you tell us what it is?
So in Japan, soba means buckwheat, also mean buckwheat noodle.
Okay, and what are ingredients?
It's a buckwheat.
And, you know, to make noodles.
Oh, I see, I see. I usually make traditional style buckwheat noodle. It's 20% wheat, 80% buckwheat, no salt, just water, just three simple ingredients.
Okay. So it sounds like, you know, the water could change the flavor and what kind of the region it comes from could change the whole thing. And you said 20% wheat and buckwheat 80%, right? And I heard there is a towari soba, means 100% buckwheat, and I heard it's very difficult to make. But why is that?
Because buckwheat doesn't have gluten, so it doesn't stick together. So you have to make super careful. It's not difficult to make, but doesn't last long.
Oh, it's a breaks because it's there's no gluten. There's no sticky thing. Right. Well, that means it's gluten-free. It's towari soba. Right. Okay. So, yeah, I heard the soba came from Japan, originally from China, in the mid-5th century, like really long history. So, it's just a crazy question, but why do you think soba is so popular? Because, you know, in any town or any train station, you find soba places than even ramen shops. So, do you have any idea why they're so popular in Japan?
Soba got popular later Edo period, along with tempura and sushi. That was popular fast food.
Okay. So, yeah, Edo period is like 17th, 18th century, right? So that was when general public became slightly richer. So middle class expanded and started to enjoy soba, sushi, and buckwheat.
And that time, people were eating white rice instead of brown rice because technology developed.
Right.
So, other people start getting very, very disease.
Ah, okay. Right.
Then people discover, okay, if I eat soba, I won't get very, very disease.
Okay.
So, it's like a health benefit.
Oh, so it's like worked as a supplement because the processed white rice didn't have any vitamins or minerals like the whole grain rice.
Right.
Interesting. Right. Okay. So, how do you make soba? What's the process? Soba noodles making process.
So I shift flour and buckwheat into a large bowl, then carefully adding water.
Okay.
Right? Using just fingertip to like mix until it became wet panko texture.
Okay. Right.
Then I'm carefully adding more water and just keep kneading.
Okay.
Until it start becoming a pinball ball size.
Right. I saw you know the soba uchi, the soba making process demonstration before, and then I noticed that the buckwheat is so absorbent. So unless you work really quickly and you have to add the water little by little, it's kind of messy. It's, texture gets really messed up in a way.
Because buckwheat protein melt in water, you cannot add too much water. Have to be light amount.
Oh, wow. Okay. And what's the temperature? It's like a room temperature?
Yeah, room temperature.
Okay. And then what's next?
Then start kneading right, until the dough gets shiny. That's like good workout for 5 minutes, right?
Right.
Then I have to push all air out inside of the dough,
okay,
so it doesn't get weird, like bubbly this technique called kiku neri, because it looks like a kiku flower.
Like a chrysanthemum
flower.
Okay. So, yeah, like kneading, and then because you roll it, as you kind of twist, it creates the shape of the flower. Interesting. Okay.
Then I squeeze that flower part into a, how to say, like a tulip flower shape. Then start making kiss chocolate, like hazy kiss chocolate shape.
Okay.
And press down. So final kneading product looks like a Gouda cheese wheel.
Okay, chrysanthemum, tulip, and kiss, and a Gouda.
Yes.
Okay.
Then finally rolling.
Okay. So rolling, and I remember the when I saw the, you know, the demonstration, the shape keeps changing interestingly, right? So maybe you can just process, you know, the, explain the process of, it's almost from, it's like a round circle.
Circle first, yeah.
To square, right? I don't know how you do it.
So you're making bigger and bigger perfect circle first. Then you roll dough into a stick. And you just like swing the stick.
Okay. So the rolling pin is really long, right? Like a Japanese sword.
It's 120 centimeters.
Okay. Which is, I don't know, I cannot say in inches, but it's pretty long.
It's like a 5 to 2 inches.
Okay. Okay.
So after like swing the circle, no, swing the circle becoming square.
So why do you make it into square?
This called kakudashi.
Okay.
Just like naturally swing the dough gets point, so you're making formal point. That point becoming you know, the shape of a square.
Right, because it's easier to cut into noodles than in circles.
Well, you have to make noodles thin, right? So you're not making just like flat big seed.
Right.
You have to like keep organizing. We usually use 3 stick, two rolling pin, no, 2 holding pin, 1 rolling pin. So you have to like roll the end. So you can like keep going to, you know, get very thin part.
Okay. Right. So eventually you make it as thin as possible. So that it doesn't break.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. And you cut it.
Yeah.
Right. So I saw the big knife to cut the noodles. It's crazy shaped. And then, yeah, and I heard it's pretty expensive too to have
it
that.
It is.
Right. How much is it? Like about?
Like 500.
Wow. It's like a big square shape, not like a Western knife. But then I heard it's if you press down, the whole pressure goes evenly throughout the knife. So you can cut the noodles evenly, right? Okay. So, what's the most difficult part in making soba noodles?
I think adding water is hard because ratio change every day, and also speed.
Okay.
Because after you finish kneading noodle, the dough is slowly getting dry. You don't want that. So it's like after a knead, you have to go, you know, as much as faster you can.
Right. Sounds like you said the ratio of water changes because if it's a moist day or dry day, you have to adjust the water. Wow.
Like cold day, more water. Hot day, less water.
Wow. And I'm sure as you process knead, the water goes out, coming out, so it can get dry if, unless you work quickly.
Yeah.
Right. Okay, so also I heard that the soba is very healthy. So what are the health benefits?
Well, people think buckwheat is actually grain, but buckwheat is not grain. It's a fruit seed.
Okay.
That means naturally gluten-free. And also buckwheat is high in protein and low in carb.
Okay.
So it's very healthy to eat.
Right, so perfect for losing weight and staying away from gluten.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right.
Also, buckwheat contains all 8 essential amino acids and antioxidant too.
Wow.
And like I I said before, it's good for prevent from beriberi disease because high contents of vitamin B.
Okay. And I also heard that it lowers blood pressure, prevents diabetes, and cancer, anti-aging, and detoxify the liver, so you can avoid hangover, kind of the whole thing.
Great for hangover.
No, really? Is it proven?
I think that's why soba is still popular in Tokyo. People eat like late night and early morning to, you know, avoid hangover.
Right, interesting. Oh, wow. Okay, so that's a health food for sure for everybody. Okay. Another thing, it's December, closer to the end of the year, and soba is a very important part of Japanese culture, and the most symbolic example is toshikoshi soba, which is, what is it?
Toshikoshi means year crossing. So toshikoshi soba is soba people eat in New Year's Eve. I had lots of story, but this custom start because of three reasons.
Okay.
You know, Japanese people are wishing long life and wealth. So simply length of noodle, of soba noodle, is wishing long life. And also sounds of eating soba, it's tsuru tsuru kame kame.
Ah, interesting.
Tsuru tsuru is slapping sound, and kame kame is chewing sound. Tsuru is crane in Japan. And people believe tsuru has 1,000 years old life.
Right. And the kame is like 10,000 years.
That's
Sort of symbolic.
So tsuru tsuru kame kame is like long life.
Right.
Other stories, goldsmith collect gold flake using buckwheat dough in his studio for cleaning. So buckwheat meaning collecting gold. So it's a wealth.
I didn't know that. I've never heard of it. That's interesting. Okay. So in any case, we have... at the New Year's Eve, if you eat noodles, you have a richer, healthier year next year. Okay. And then works for hangover. So it's perfect. Right. Okay. So where can we eat your soba now?
Well, I don't have a restaurant right now, so I'm occasionally doing pop-up, like once a month.
In Seattle? Okay.
Well, if someone invites me, I can go anywhere. So,
okay.
Please invite me.
Right. Or maybe New Year's Eve this year. Right. And so you just had a pop-up with Shota Nakajima Abunaka, who was our guest on episode 63. So how did it go?
Was good. His restaurant is so beautiful. And he has like old beautiful plate from Japan. And he's such a young, talented chef.
Right. So Naka is a kaiseki restaurant, and then using local Seattle ingredients with the traditional technique that he learned in Kyoto.
Right.
So you threw in soba elements in his kaiseki. Oh wow! So what kind of soba did you make?
We use wagyu beef from Washington State, and also matsutake mushroom from Washington State.
Wow!
So it's like a sukiyaki style wagyu beef matsutake dipping sauce with soba.
Wow, I wish I was able to be there.
It was super good.
Right. Okay, so that kind of pop-ups, you work with different chefs?
Also, I do demonstration.
Wow, so in Seattle only? Okay, so maybe you should come to New York.
I should.
Right. So are you planning to open another soba restaurant sometime in the future?
Yes.
Okay, so what kind of...
So, you know, end of the meal, people say gochisou sama in Japan. Gochisou sama meaning literally, like, thank you for running around. Because back time, people have to running around to collect ingredients. Like, makes sense. So, gochisou sama deshita means thank you for running around to collect food for me. So that's kind of my grandma did to our family. So that's kind of my new restaurant concept, like homage to my grandmother. So I will like running around to collect local ingredient. Like Japanese believe there's 24 micro season in a year. I think Northwest has same. So I will focus to using like high peak season, like shun season. Of Northwest.
Wow, it's interesting. Yeah, we've been talking a lot about Kyoto cuisine, which has 24 seasons instead of four. So Seattle, I didn't know there's so many of them. Right, that's great. Okay, so any timeline? Maybe in next year, in 3 years?
Maybe next year, next year.
Okay.
Not too far.
Right. So in Seattle. Maybe, right. Maybe in 10 years you can extend to New York too. Right. I think because soba restaurants are, they are great soba restaurants, but I don't think it's enough compared to ramen.
True.
Right.
Also, I will focusing on tempura with local ingredient. I think I believe best format to bring out the flavor for fresh local seasonal ingredient with Japanese way, and soba and tempura goes together.
Right, naturally.
Yeah.
You said the typical one is tempura soba. Right. Okay, well, the soba, I think tempura is very local and sustainable dish because you can put the koromo, the coating, and then you can pack the flavor and flash cook. So it's a really lively flavor and the seasonal ingredients eaten at the same time.
Yep.
Right. Okay. Great. So please keep us posted on your restaurants.
I will.
Okay, so thank you for joining us today, Mitsuko.
Thank you so much.
So listeners, if you'd like to know more about Mitsuko's pop-up events and her updates, please go to facebook.com/kamonegiseattle. That is on facebook.com/kamonegi. It's K-A-M-O-G-E-G-I, K-O-M-O-G-E-G-I, Seattle. And if you have any questions or comments about the show or suggestions for guests or topics of the show, please contact us at japaneats@heritageradionetwork.org. And Japaneats is live at 3 p.m. on Mondays and always available at heritageradionetwork.org, iTunes and Stitcher podcasts. And please go to iTunes and Stitcher and write a review. We appreciate your feedback. Today's show is made possible by Brooklyn Ball Factory. And our engineer is David Tatasiore. And thank you for listening. And by the way, we'll take a break for the holiday season. And the next show will be on January 9th. So have a great New Year, everyone.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Listeners, we want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola El Waley, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.